I'm Denise.
She's a non-fiction editor. And I'm Louise.
She's a fiction editor. And together,
we're the Editing Podcast.
Hello again, and welcome to another episode of the Editing Podcast. So this time around, we're going to take a look at editing and proofreading ELT materials.
That's right, we are indeed. Now, the little I know about this, I've learned from someone who knows a lot, and that's you, Denise.
Me.
Because it's one of your specialisms. And so This week, I'm basically going to be the one doing the easy bit, asking all the questions. I'll just put my feet up. Give me a minute.
Not so fast, Harmby. I demand your full attention. But yeah, you're right that this is one of my specialisms, and I'm really looking forward to chatting to you about it.
So am I. So let's kick off. First off, ELT, that stands for English Language Teaching. That much I know. But who's teaching what and to whom? Because it sounds like a huge field.
It is. So I think we could start with the definition that the British Council uses, because it's pretty succinct. And they say ELT refers to the activity and industry of teaching English to speakers of other languages.
Isn't that TEFL? I mean, I hear people talking about EFL clients or being a TEFL teacher. What's the difference?
Yeah, sometimes they can be used interchangeably, but EFL refers to English as a foreign language. And that is learning and using English as an additional language in a non-English speaking country. So, for example, Mateo in Spain is learning English at school. That is EFL. TEFL is teaching EFL, T-E-F-L, and is often used to refer to a certificate or a job. So Louise got a TEFL certificate and is going to teach EFL in Spain. The course book she'll use is produced by a major ELT publisher.
Carry
you
on.
Got that?
Yeah,
yes.
Yeah.
Uh-huh. There's also ESOL, which stands for English for Speakers of Other Languages. And that refers to learning English as a new resident in an English-speaking country. So, for example, my friend Emily taught ESOL here in Glasgow to refugees. Okay, and that can also be known as EAL, which is English as an additional language.
Ah, right. Now, I was aware of EAL, and I'm glad that's in the mix, because the term second language, it can sometimes, to people who aren't aware, working in this field, it can come along with a sort of quality inference rather than a language that's being learned second or after the one that you started speaking.
Your L1,
anyway, there are a lot of acronyms, it would seem. So it's good to have a head up about this.
Yeah.
So going back to ELT, can you explain a bit more about that bit you mentioned, the activity and industry of teaching English to speakers of other languages?
Yeah, so that bit, that it encompasses the schools, the colleges, universities that have formal courses to teach English. It includes the publishers who create the materials to support those courses. It includes the teachers who deliver the courses, the language teachers outside of formal settings who give small group and individual lessons in other settings, such as maybe in large businesses or organisations or in small local community settings. And of course, the position and perspective that I have, I'm one of the freelancers who work on those materials for the publishers.
Big, isn't it?
There's a lot going on there. It's a massive, massive industry. I recently copy edited and proofread a book called The Future of English for the British Council. And it reported on the early stages of a long-term project that the British Council are doing on this topic, what is the future of English? And one of the interesting facts it shared was based on work that was done by David Crystal in 2018. So yeah, the numbers will have changed a bit in the intervening 6 years, but it still gives you a flavour of the scale of what's going on here.
I'm bracing myself. Go on, hit me.
So, Crystal indicated that approximately 2.3 billion of the 7.5 billion people on the planet speak English. And that's about 31%.
Wow, that is a lot.
It is, but there's more. Of them, so that's of that 2.3 billion, only 388 million speak English as their L1 or first language. So that means around about 1.9 billion people speak English as an additional language.
Incredible.
And even more are exposed to English, even if they don't speak it.
And would I be right in assuming that most of those 1.9 billion people are learning English via materials produced by the ELT publishing industry?
You would be absolutely right.
That is one heck of a lot of content being created.
It really is, isn't it? As I
Yeah.
said, it is a huge market. And of course, it's not one big homogeneous mass. You can break it down in lots of different ways. The obvious one is by the level of English that's been taught. And that level will have been benchmarked to a framework. And one of the most commonly used is the Common European Framework of Reference for Languages, or CEFR for short. And that is produced by the Council of Europe.
Yes, another acronym. So
Yeah.
tell me, what's the CEFR all about?
Yeah, so again, I'm going to quote from other people. The Council of Europe's own words here. So the CEFR provides a common basis for the elaboration of language syllabuses, curriculum guidelines, examinations, textbooks, etc., across Europe. So it's the CEFR that determines the six proficiency levels that some listeners will be familiar with, is because this doesn't just apply to English, it applies to other modern foreign languages such as French, German, Italian, that sort of thing. So it's six proficiency levels: A1, A2, B1, B2, C1, C2. And that ranges from complete beginner at A1 to pretty much completely fluent at C2.
Okie doke. So, okay, you said before one of the most commonly used. So there are other frameworks, I'm assuming.
There are, yeah. And again, one of the most commonly used ones alongside CEFR is the global scale of English, and where the CEFR relates to work done in Europe, the global scale of English has been developed to be applied globally. Okay. And it was developed by publishing giant Pearson, and they use it for all of their language teaching and learning materials.
GSE. Oh, right. So, yeah, global scale of English.
Yes. It's another
Another,
acronym.
it's another acronym.
Anyway, sorry, I realise I am overloading you with acronyms. We'll move on from these soon. But anyway, the GSE assesses four skills, as does the CEFR, and the GSE is on a scale of 10 to 90 rather than that A1 to C2 range.
Okie doke. And
Okay.
what are those skills?
So we all have four language skills. So we have reading and listening, which are receptive skills. And we have writing and speaking, which are productive skills. And obviously, students have to develop all of those skills. And course book writers and editors make sure that the scope and sequence of a course book or a syllabus cover each of them, along with the usual vocabulary and grammar lessons that they're delivered through. So the materials are also created that focus on these skills individually as well.
Okay, so you can categorize ELT by the level of English being taught, but how else is it done?
So I think the easiest way to think about it is in terms of the students who are using the materials. So for example, students at schools will have materials created for them to reflect not only the level of English they're le learning, but also their age.
Right, yeah, I can see how that
Okay.
makes sense because you want to deliver the language using topics that will appeal to them. And if you're seven, it's not going to be the same as if you're 17.
Exactly. The way you do that is to hold their interest and encourage them to engage with the language. So for primary pupils, that might be language around school and friends and family and holidays and toys and things like that. While teenagers might engage more with content about technology or the climate crisis or what teenagers in other countries do.
Okay, so let's imagine Matteo, who we mentioned earlier as an example, I think, goes he's
Yeah.
in Spain and he goes through four years of English lessons rather at school and reaches, I don't know, a lower intermediate level. What would you
Yeah, so
what
that would
number
be
for that?
probably about A2-ish.
Okay.
Yeah.
Right, and that's good enough for Matteo to communicate as a tourist in English-speaking countries. He can have conversations on familiar topics. And then let's imagine he leaves education and 10 years later he's got some job with a company in Madrid, and then that company lands some huge contract, long-term contract with a company based in Scotland, let's say,
Of
naturally.
course, of course.
But now he needs not only to brush up on the English he learned at school, but also learn the vocabulary that's relevant to his work. And that's going to be really different.
Yeah, that's right. It's now about things like intercultural communication and improving his language skills beyond socializing and into workplace communication so that he can work in a team, he can negotiate, he can manage people, deal with conflict, and so on.
Yeah, and of course the course books that were used in school are not going to cut it, are
No,
they?
no.
And nor his A2 skills, yeah.
Yeah, they're not, because they're 10 years old now as well, and he's probably only used them when he's been on holiday and that sort of thing. So he'll need to brush up on his skills and then progress perhaps to B1 or B2 level. And the stuff he'll need to do that needs to be geared to adults and more specifically to business or even his specific area of business.
Right, yeah. Because
Yeah.
if you're working in, say, the pharmacological industry, or, working for Big Pharma, say, or
Yeah.
you're working for an international media company, that's two very, very different areas of business. Or
Absolutely.
one I remember you talking, your husband talking about, which was, if you're working in an industry, say, you're an air traffic controller, where people's
Absolutely.
lives are on the line, you need to be
Yeah,
able to communicate. Yeah.
you need the specific what's called meta language, so the language that specifically mean is geared towards those particular sort of situations you'll find yourself in. And that's why we don't just have general courses for adults, which we do have, but we also have business English materials and much more.
Do those have an acronym?
Ha ha. Funny you should ask that, Louise, because yes, they do.
Do they?
Yeah, it's ESP, which stands for English for Specific Purposes. And those materials are really closely tailored to the specific needs of English students in a particular specialised field or profession, such as the ones you've mentioned, but things like healthcare, the oil and gas industry, mining, hotel management, pretty much anything that you can think of will need tailored language learning content.
Okay, and what about students who want to study at an English speaking university, for example? Surely they're going to need some stuff to help them too.
And they do. And that's another area of content the editors work on. Materials that help students to pass the English tests to demonstrate that they have the proficiency at the necessary level to study in English. So these are books and materials to help them prepare for the IELTS. Don't ask, I'm already on it, Hanby. That's the International English Language Testing System. But no one calls it that, everyone calls it IELTS. So
Okay.
the IELTS test is one that universities will ask for a score between certain numbers, maybe between 7 and it goes up to 9, I think it is. But you need to be at the higher level, obviously, to pass that
Sure.
and get into university. And then there's also the TOEIC, which is the Test of English for International Communication. And I think that one's more common in the States. But both of those are pretty much the standard that most universities will look
Yeah.
for people to get in.
I need a drink. I mean, seriously.
Well, do you know, I'm not done.
Course you're not.
There
Carry
are
on.
also materials for EAP, which stands for English for Academic Purposes. And these materials focus on things like the language structures and techniques specific to the academic world. We all know that academics write differently from the way you would write, a journal or something, like a journal article or something, a journal entry, not a journal article. So, I'm telling you, I could go on. There are whole areas that I haven't even touched on, but what we've discussed so far should give you a flavor of just how broad the industry is.
And a bit of a headache, if I'm honest. I'm used to acronyms like LAPD, FBI, and CSI. But anyway, so tell me, what's your role in all this? So I know you do copy editing and proofreading, but what does that involve for ELT materials? And what's different about it compared with, say, the kind of work you might do on a social science monograph or a journal article if you're editing or proofreading those?
Well, actually, the fundamentals of copy editing and proofreading, they remain the same. You still have the same types of tasks and expectations from your client when you're doing these roles. But there are certain steps that you may not be familiar with if you've not worked on teaching educational materials before. So, for example, when you're copy editing, you might be asked to extract the answers from the exercise to create the answer key.
And then I guess you have to check that the answers match the questions and they're correct, yeah?
Absolutely, exactly. And you might also have to create or populate artwork and photo briefs based on what the author has written and make sure that they're labelled correctly and tagged in the file at the right point. So, for example, imagine an exercise where students have to match the words bike, skateboard, basketball, football and ice skates to photos of each of these. So you've got a list of these things, and on the other side you've got a list of these images, and the students have to draw lines between them to match them up. Just gonna say each image will have a file name and they have to be recorded in the Word file in the correct positions so that the designer knows where to put these photos, the order to put them in.
That's really interesting because in the past, I mean, years ago when I did more generalist editing, I remember having a piece of work, like it was like a coffee table book.
Yeah.
And one of the things that I had to do was to make sure that the captions, the description matched the images. But you know what? I mean, it would have been a sloppy piece of editing if I hadn't spotted that the violin was actually a trombone. But, it, you know, it wasn't going to affect anybody. Do you know what I mean? Whereas when you're talking about teaching people how to communicate, that being wrong, that ruins their learning.
It does. It confuses them. Mm. And it also would make them lack confidence in other things being correct.
Yes. Yes.
You know, if they've got that wrong, what else have they got wrong that I haven't noticed? So it's very much about credibility as well, you know.
I'd like to think that explains why many years ago when I smoked, I went and asked a French person for, well, I thought I was asking for a light, but I was actually asking for sunglasses. And but it's that kind of, do you know what I mean? Again, hardly sort of like earth-shatteringly critical, but and in a very different setting. But
that could persist. They could have the wrong word for basketball for the rest of their lives if they're not sure.
Exactly. And who knows what could happen.
Yeah.
And does this kind of work apply to, I don't know, things like audio and video scripts too? Do you get involved with them?
Yeah, definitely. So often when an author turns in a unit or a chapter, everything is in one file. They have one file and it's got the learning points, it's got the activities and exercises, the answers to them, the scripts for the video and any audio that are supplementing it. And as copy editor, your job is to remove them and create separate documents for them all. So you have a separate file for each type of asset. So they're all referred to as assets, okay? So each audio or video script needs to also be numbered sequentially. And again, you have to make sure it's referenced at the correct point in the lesson. So an exercise on pronunciation might have six different things for them to listen to for six different sounds. And you got to make sure that they're the right sounds in the right order.
That is quite a lot of additional things to take care of at copy edit stage, isn't it? I mean, compared to if you were, like we talked about just a minute ago, compared to if you were, you know, proofreading or copy editing an article for, you know, the journal Party Politics or something.
I mean, you would have things, obviously, in the journal article that aren't here, like references and maybe figures and tables and things, but there are so many different elements that are involved in a typical student book that we're talking about here, or a workbook layout, that it's quite a complex thing to make sure that you've addressed all of these things.
Yeah, and it's that kind of, it's just about remembering, like, when we talk about copy editing, when we use these terms, copy editing, proofreading, they don't necessarily require the same skill sets. It's not that one's more important or that one's better than the other, but there are differences, aren't
They're
there? Depending
different.
On the and this is a really good example of a field where you know you have to be prepared to engage in a bit of a different way.
Yeah, I mean, I'm not worrying about, you know, action beats and dialogue tags
Yeah.
or, you know, or
Yeah.
narrative arc or anything like that. But I'm juggling lots of different elements that are going to appear on a page and got to make sure that they all turn up in the right place at the right time.
So what
So,
else? Oh,
yeah, no, go on.
I was wondering what kind of things do you need to be familiar with? What helps you organize yourself? Because that's what we're talking about here. It seems to me like you need to be really well organized.
So it helps to be familiar with, for copy editing, word styles and templates, because all of those different elements that I've talked about there, they need to be identified clearly, and you might be provided with a template to use, or you might be asked to create your own simple template for these things.
Yeah.
Or you might be asked to use coding tags. I still do get asked be asked to use them on occasion. And other elements that I've not mentioned, like grammar boxes, exam tips, pronunciation notes, word pools, word lists, they all should have clearly designed, defined styles as well, so that the typesetter can set the pages correctly. So there's a lot to keep track of. You don't need
Absolutely.
to style them like they're anything like they're going to look on the actual page. You just need to style it as that this section is a grammar box, and whether that grammar box is in a, you know, 50% blue tint, you know, in a box halfway down a page, that's for the designer to sort out. He just knows that that bit there is a grammar box.
And what about language level? Are you looking out for that as well? Is that your responsibility?
It's not my responsibility as a copy editor, because the content should have been finalized and established by the content editor. But it is worth keeping an eye on, having in mind what level you're working at, because sometimes things do slip through. And sometimes you might just get a feeling that a vocab item just maybe seems a bit too high for the level of the book that you're working at. So it's not that you have to look specifically look for these things as a copy editor, but there are vocab lists online that you can refer to for different levels, or you might need to check with the production editor and just flag it and say, is this right? And it might be right, but it's better to flag it and be told it's okay than to leave it in, you know.
So you've got to be mindful. It's not overall, it's not your job, but it's about sort of that's just part of the role about keeping your mind on that.
Yeah, and actually, I think this is it's not something I was particularly planning on mentioning, but I think it's important to say here that a lot of people think that you have to have a background in teaching to do this. Okay. I've never been an English teacher. I have no EFL certificate or anything. The people that write the materials obviously do, and the content editors obviously do. But as a copy editor, your focus is on all these things that we've spoken about already. You don't need to have a teaching background. Over the years, I've come to understand an awful lot more about teaching this than I ever would. Still doesn't make me a teacher, but I have a much better sense of when things will and won't work. So I feel that now I'm better able to flag things than I would have 10 years ago.
And you're basically, you're coming to the role, your job is to be the editor, but like anybody who's got a lot of experience in some things, you're able to contextualize things in a way that I wouldn't be able to if I was coming to this as a beginner, because I wouldn't. And it's about sort of learning the what's important and what it's that thing that we you and I have talked about before, like you don't know what you don't know, and just sort of
And it's
building.
understanding, it's also understanding how these materials are used, and not having had a teaching background to begin with, I didn't really have much insight into that. But spending time with people who do, going to events where they talk about these things, like conferences and away days and things, I've got a much clearer picture in my head about how all these things work.
Yeah, because you're talking to the pr practitioners,
Yes,
and so
absolutely.
you're seeing it from their perspective, and that just surely has to enrich your what you bring to the table editorially, because you can
Absolutely.
put yourself in their shoes, and but also as a non-teacher. As a speaker of language, though, you can come to it from the point of the user.
Yeah, absolutely. So, you know, if I was a teacher, would this make sense to me? I've got a much better sense of that now than I did 10 years ago, you know.
So what about proofreading, Denise? Is that very different?
Well, again, as with copy editing, I would say the fundamentals are absolutely the same. You're looking for errors that have slipped through, either because they've been missed at copy editing stage, which happens, it's a fact of life, or they've been introduced at layout stage, and you want to check that all of the material is present and correct. But like with copy editing, there are lots of other things to consider. For a start, you're not If you're sometimes you're asked to do a cold proofread, but some other times, if you're doing first proofs, it's common to be checking the PDF against the copy edited file, the page plan for the book, and the design sample. And it's very common to get a design sample because that shows you what a double page spread, sort of one lesson, would look like,
What it looks like.
actually laid out. So, yeah. It's
So,
so first proofs would be that, checking against all those things. Second proofs, you might be checking against first proofs, or you might just be doing that as a cold proofread.
about you take us through a list of the things that people who are thinking perhaps of going into this field and kind of want to get a feel for. What kind of things they might need to be aware of? What heads up can you give them?
That's a good idea. Okay, so this is in no way exhaustive, but it gives you a sense of the sort of scope. So think of you're doing all your proofreading things about your text, but when it comes to how it looks on the page, you've got to make sure that your layout, styles, and formatting are correct so that it matches your design plan if you have one. So things like colours, bold, italic, underline, strike through, bullets, all that sort of thing are used correctly for each element, for example, and haven't got mixed up with each other. You want to look for things like icons. So you would have icons for your audio and video, but you might have icons for group work or pair work. Are they all present in the right place? Are they numbered correctly where they are numbered? Are you cross-checking absolutely everything that appears in more than one place? Now, that could be things like the contents list with the lesson plans, but also learning objectives, can-do statements, all that sort of thing. And it also includes cross-referencing between different pieces of material. So you might be working on a teacher's book and you're having to cross-reference activities in the teacher's book with the student's book and the workbook and making sure that everything matches up. The numbering of questions against answer keys, do they match up? Are the answers correct? Are they in the right order? Have you made sure that all the photos and artwork are correct against the brief? Sometimes they're not in place at first proofs. Sometimes there's maybe just low res versions of things. Sometimes you won't see them until second proofs, but check what you can. And one thing that I was surprised to get asked to do when I first got asked to do it, but I now realise it's not that unusual to get asked at proofreading stage, is dealing with over matter, where there's just too much material on the page and they're looking for suggestions to make cuts.
Right, that's quite a copy editory thing.
It's even a content editory thing, even before con,
It's true.
because what you're being asked to do is maybe there might be an exercise with 10 questions in it and they've only got room for eight, just say.
So you actually have to t decide what to delete.
You don't just necessarily chop numbers 9 and 10 off
No,
because you
no.
have to make sure that all the activities cover all the learning points that you have. So when I was first asked to do that, I was very nervous of it, but I just warned them, I'm not used to doing this. I'll have a go. And I did it, and I'm getting more, I'm still getting more confident. There are still some things that I'll say, this is over, but I can't make a suggestion. I'm not sure what to say. The thing that when you do that, if you're cutting things out of the exercises, are they getting cut out of the answer key? So you need to make sure
Again,
that.
that cross-referencing thing.
And sometimes when you get proofs back, they'll have cut and then reordered and renumbered the questions. Again, does that match with the answer key? So
God, the knock-on effects could be potentially catastrophic, especially
they're
if you've got
just
like all these
crazy.
different files open and there's a bit of audio here and an image there and like, a student book, a teacher's book. Ugh.
And
Anyway.
sometimes it takes a while to just get the shape of it all in your head, the clear where everything works, So, yeah, it's a
Great,
lot.
that's really useful. So we kind of nudged on this. Can you talk a little bit about the sensitivity checks you might do?
Yeah, so one of the things that ELT editors and proofreaders need to be aware of is the market that the materials they're working on are intended for. So, for example, I might be asked to flag any images that show bare arms and legs because of modesty rules in a market, or dice and card games because of gambling. Or maybe alcohol or hand products because of religious beliefs. And these things may not have been communicated clearly to maybe the illustrator or the photo researcher. So you're just doing a double check to make sure that nothing slipped through. I was once asked to make sure there were no flags in any pictures, which it was for China. I don't quite know why, but it was there. I'll also, whether or not I've been asked, I will flag anything that I think reinforces stereotyping.
So I guess that might mean, for example, if a unit about careers it had just had men showing doing all the STEM jobs and the women only doing things like caring or secretarial work or sweeping the floor, that kind
Yeah,
of thing. Is that a reasonable
exactly. Yeah,
example?
and I'll just suggest that they find a better mix of photographs. You know, can we find a female engineer, or something like that? So, yeah, I don't know what they may or may not do anything about it at that stage. They may not have the time or the budget to deal with it, but I flagged it.
But I suppose that's something I would do in a novel as well. Sometimes I'll point out a potential sensitivity issue to an author. I'm not prescribing a change, but I flagged it up, and it's something for them to think about
Absolutely.
and consider. Denise, what kind of format are these materials coming in? Is it just books or
Other stuff.
sort of, yeah, or other stuff?
So the core materials are generally books. So your student book,
Things you
your
can hold.
workbook, your teacher's book, things that are going to be used in the classroom, in the students' hands. But you can imagine that with technology now, learning content can be delivered to students in all sorts of ways. So I've worked on a lot of digital materials on learning management systems. I've worked on e-books. I've worked on language lessons that are actually going to be delivered via mobile phones. I've worked on web content, games, presentation materials on PowerPoint decks. I mean, the list is literally endless. And people are getting more and more creative about how they deliver learning materials.
Interesting, because I mean, you were talking before about how that importance of getting the level when content creators are ensuring that they've got the level right depending on their audience. So for children, for example, or adults actually, games, playing games can be a really great way of learning for us all, because we don't realize we're learning, we don't feel like we're learning, but actually we are.
That's it. Gamifying content and language learning is a massive thing. So, lots of publishers have moved into that sort of area to deliver what students want, basically. That's how they want to learn. They don't want to sit down and learn lists of grammar and conjugate verbs and things like that. They can learn these things in much more fun and interesting ways than probably you or I ever learnt language when we were at school, It's
That reminds me, actually, years ago, I did some light copy editing for an educational publisher, and I remember doing this. The book was really interesting. It was a language arts book, and the people were teachers, and they were talking about how their methods for teaching children additional languages. So say a child comes over from moves from England to France, what's the best way to help that person learn French if they don't know it already? And they were talking about how actually doing a chemistry lesson, but doing your best to try and do it in French, like learning the French through the business of learning about chemistry, where it's informal, where the focus is on test tubes and mixing things together. And they found that it was it's not a million miles away from the gamifying issue, in a sense that they weren't being told, like, today you are going to learn a language. They were saying, today we're going to do stuff with chemistry, we're going to learn about how this part of science works. And yes, of course, at first they might not be able to understand, but the teacher was primed for that, so they might help and encourage them and be teaching. So your chemistry teacher would also be a language arts teacher. They would have those skills, and the the children learnt their additional languages so much more quickly, but they also got better results in their chemistry. It's just amazing.
Would you like to know the acronym for that?
Yeah.
It's called CLIL, which stands for Content and Language Integrated Learning. And that's a term to use when you're teaching content like physics or geography or something like that through the medium of a foreign language and learning that foreign language by studying a content-based subject. So
it's an amazingly interesting area. I mean, if you're an editor, but you're not working on these kinds of materials, we all still learn. And we're all still faced with situations where we might come into contact with people who speak different languages to us, or we're visiting places where the primary language being spoken is not one that we know or that we're at the beginning of learning. And I just think it's incredibly interesting area, just from a sort of like armchair perspective.
Yeah. Oh, no, it really is. And I've worked on books on sort of, you know, pedagogy for aimed at teachers to improve their practice. And it's just fascinating. Yeah. It's just a whole different world. And you just learn such a lot just by listening to other people talking about stuff that they really know their stuff, and that you're tangentially related to that somehow, you know.
Yeah. So are you always working on screen? And if so, what kind of kit do you recommend?
So absolutely, almost always working on screen. I don't think I've ever had hard copy to work on for ELT. The only exception to that is I've done a few post-production proofreads where the materials have already been published and they want it to be proofread because they know that they're going to bring out another edition and they want somebody to do it on the page. So I've done that a couple of times, which is actually great fun because it makes a nice change. But otherwise, always on screen. So as you would imagine, with doing copy editing, being proficient with Microsoft Word is really essential. And for proofreading, Adobe Reader DC, the free version, that's all you need for proofreading, is essential as well. Okay. And I say Adobe Reader DC because all the books that I work on are created in InDesign. And to me, it's just safer to use software from the same family so that it all plays nicely together. I know that other PDF markup platforms are available, but I just like to stick with
That's a really good point. That makes sense. So whenever I'm working in with PDFs, I'm not editing in PDFs. I'm just using PDF as a tool to create a bit of content. Yeah. I'm always using something like PDF Exchange. But this makes absolute sense because you know those two pieces, Reader DC and InDesign, you know they're going to talk to each other.
Yeah.
You're not going to get any surprises, anything not showing up that should be.
Exactly. Yeah. And especially now when at proofreading stage, they can just import all your connections for, you know, insert, substitute, delete. They can all just be imported straight in without having to be rekeyed. And that's amazing. Just easier if it's, you know, DC.
So
that just makes sure it all plays nicely. The other thing is it's not unusual for some types of content, like lists of assets and things, to be held in Excel spreadsheets. So just knowing the basics of that, I think, is important too.
And it sounds like you're often, well, no, it doesn't sound like, I know, because you've said, you're often working on several different files and cross-checking between them. So you talked earlier about, you know, maybe your audio files and video files, but also workbooks, teacher books, student books, teacher books. So any recommendations on dealing with that, with all these different pieces of content that you might have, you might be in play during your couple of hours in front of the computer or whatever?
So I think for this, the more real estate you have to display on, the better. So I think two screens really is an absolute minimum. I just can't imagine doing it with any less than that. I work with two external monitors plus my laptop, so that's three. And it's not unusual for me to have my iPad open as well and my phone. Is that five?
Exactly.
You know,
makes perfect sense. I just, for my work, I find having two screens really, really useful. I can't imagine working without two. And I'm not, you know, I've maybe got my novel file open and then my style sheet. That's it, you know, like, and I'm not having, that's me controlling my working process. You're actually having to cross-check things. So I can actually see why you need that kind of real estate available to make your working life, you know, make you productive.
Absolutely. It's efficiency, isn't it? And, you know, some people might think, well, you can just toggle through different, you know, tabs on your laptop screen or whatever. And I'm like, no, because lots of the file names might look quite similar, and it's very easy to just start marking up the wrong thing in the wrong place. So, you know, separate stuff out as much as you possibly can.
So who are your clients? I don't mean, please, Denise, hand over your client list. I mean, what kinds of people do you work with? Authors, businesses, publishers?
So for ELT Materials, I work with publishers, publishing clients globally. Some are UK-based, but I've worked with publishers in the USA, Brazil, Mexico, Hong Kong, Korea, France, Spain, Greece, Italy, anywhere. Anywhere people are learning English, those 1.9 billion people.
Quite a lot.
They're everywhere. So it's, absolutely. So they're the main sort of publishers, but I've also worked with NGOs, businesses and organizations and schools that produce their own ELT materials. And of course, like so many other areas of publishing, much of the ELT editorial work is being outsourced these days. So I work with several different packagers as well.
Right. So quite a good range there.
Yeah. Nice range, actually.
Yeah. So what kinds of skills do you need to edit ELT materials? I can imagine you need to be incredibly well organized. I talked about that just a moment ago, given the type of content you're dealing with, especially when these things like answer keys are in play.
Yeah. I think being really organized is absolutely key. And being able to get up to speed with a new style guide and lots of project specific details quickly is also a big plus. When you first start on a new project, it can feel really overwhelming because you're getting so much content presented to you, you know, with a different style guide. And,
like that shape thing you were talking about. Kind of understanding the shape of it. Of
that's
the
it. And it's taking some time and not feeling panicked that I've got to dive straight into this and start editing immediately. But let me just get the feel of it and the shape of it. And a good brief from the publisher makes such a massive difference to that as well. I'm so happy when I get a really clear brief. It doesn't always happen because sometimes things are just happening so quickly, they don't have time to do one. But the other thing I think is having a good general knowledge is really helpful with educational material too. You know, when you just get that spidey sense tingling, you know, whether it's a fact that just feels a bit off or something that you know for sure, you know, is wrong. For example, Shakespeare wasn't born on the 23rd of June. It was the 23rd of April. You know, you've just got a little fact that's stuck in your mind and it just appears on the page and you go, oh, that's not right. Mm-hmm. I know for a fact, but I still go and double check it, you know. Yes. So.
Well, and I suppose if you don't, and if someone listening to this was thinking, oh, I'm not sure my general knowledge isn't, then that's a really good heads up to just, you know, when you see things like that. Check. If you're checking and you feel that you have got a reasonably good general knowledge, then and you know, that's it's interesting you say that because I think sometimes when it comes to different types of editing, it is being aware of that it sometimes, whether you're a good fit for it, it doesn't always come down to which courses have I taken, what have I learned, which books have I read, what qualifications have I got. It's about something, it's about sort of understanding, you know, yes, you could read Butcher's copy editing cover to cover, but will that help you?
Yeah.
Is there more that you need to get your head around? I mean, it was really interesting just now when you were saying what you do when you one of these big projects arrives on your editing desk. And in a sense, it, you know, there are some people who the type of work they do will mean that they can literally just open the file and get going.
Yeah.
You know that you have to take the time to step back, take a breather, and just sort of almost immerse yourself in not in the actual editing, in actually understanding what the shape is, as you called it, the shape of this project looks like.
Yeah. And it's not an instant thing. And sometimes it's only once I've maybe done, you know, the first unit or maybe even the first couple of units that I get a real feel for what I'm looking for and then get more efficient, and your processes all start to come together. And it might even make me go back and look at that first unit again, just to look at it through that lens of really understanding how all this fits together. Because it could just feel that there's so many disparate elements to it. Like I said before, all these different files, and you've got learning objectives and can-do statements and, all these different tasks and tips and there's a lot to assimilate, and it does, you can't just dive in because you will miss stuff. I'll give you an example. I just dived into something once. It was quite early on, when I hadn't been editing for that long. It was proofreading, actually. It wasn't editing. And I was on this page and I was editing, I was proofreading this text. It was, I don't know, it was a text about a country or something. I can't remember what it was. And there were so many errors in it, so many spelling errors and grammar errors. I'm like, who wrote this? What on earth is going on? And I was marking up all these and thinking, what is going on? When I took a step back and looked at the page as a whole, rather than just at that specific thing, I realized it was part of an exercise for students to do. And they had to find the errors. And I just had wasted my time marking up something. And if I had sent that back to the client they would not have been happy.
Context is everything, isn't it?
Absolutely.
I mean, do you know what? Actually, that reminds me of it's different, but it's the same. I find that in fiction editing, like that thing about I might go back and relook at what I did in a first chapter when I'm line editing, because I might think, actually, I know that character better now.
And
it's not a million miles away from what you're talking about. And
it's the same principle, isn't it?
Yeah, it is. Mm-hmm. And I had an example the other day when I was working on a thing and this character kept referring to this other character as a lady. And I felt that it was really kind of like, I just thought, call her woman.
You know? Felt off to you.
It did felt off. So I didn't actually change it, but I made a note of it to query with the author. And I've only, it's right at the beginning of the book and I've only just started. I don't know much about this character yet. We're on sort of page one or two. But what is revealed as I got onto page three, that I'm actually dealing with a child. And actually children often use language that maybe their parents use or their grandparents use. And it was entirely appropriate for her, this perspective character, to use the term lady to describe this older woman. And because she was like 7 years old or something,
isn't it?
But it was only sort of like a little bit further down that I went back and I thought, remove that comment. That's absolutely, I can see that now, but I had to see the shape of this character emerging. And it's exactly the same principle as what you're doing with these big multifaceted projects, in a sense, just taking in the context.
Isn't it amazing that there are still commonalities between such different types of editing?
But you and I often find that, don't we?
Yeah.
Like how many times have you talked about a situation that you were dealing with maybe the way you're working with an author who's doing who's written a business book, or or now here we are with ELT materials, and we always the fundamental principles or the mindset that we need to come into play in addition to our editorial skills is there are so many commonalities between fiction, non-fiction, and all the bits in between.
It's lovely, isn't it? It's lovely to be able to explore, to have a conversation like this and discover these commonalities, because they're not always obvious.
Yeah, and it's one of the reasons why I think I really like the fact that the two of us have got these different areas, which turn out not to be so different all the time.
Yes.
So, Denise, back to ELT. There are going to be people listening to this who are thinking it's a big market. There's potentially a lot of work available. If I get the skills, where do you recommend people go to find out more about this field?
So obvious place is following ELT publishers on social media, see who's following them, engage with them. There's a lot goes on LinkedIn. There's a lot goes on Instagram. So find ELT publishers, find people that are using ELT hashtags, and follow them. I think I've still got a couple of lists on X, formerly Twitter, of ELT people that are public. So, you could always go to my Twitter or X account and see those lists there. In terms of community, an excellent community is education publishing professionals. Now, they used to be called ELT publishing professionals, but they've
Okay.
recently expanded their reach into general education. You can see by how what I've been talking about how all of this would apply to education materials that are not ELT, any kind of teaching materials. So they are a paid membership community. They have a directory that publishers pay to access, and they have job opportunities advertised almost every day to members that publishers do through them. They also have a great away day, which is usually comes around in September. That has interesting sessions, really excellent networking opportunities.
You always go to that, don't
I
you?
go every year. I've gone every year since about 2015 or 16, I think it was. They also have a lot of, they usually have a publisher's fair there with lots of publishers looking to boost their freelance databases. So it's a really good networking and just lovely to see the people that work there. And they also do, I think it's every 2 months they do CPD webinars as well. So
Wow.
it's a good community to be part of. So that's, I would say, for membership, that's really super. Also, if you're looking for resources, ELT Teacher to Writer, that's the name of the sort of publisher, if you like. They are all former materials writers. Some of them do still write materials in ELT and editors. And they have produced a really excellent series of books on writing ELT materials. Now, I'm not an ELT writer, but I've got several of their titles because they're really useful in understanding what best practice is. So they're great reference books.
Brilliant. Honestly, Denise, this has been so informative that I know for sure this isn't my wheelhouse. But what you've done is given editors who are thinking about moving into this field or already know they want to a really excellent overview, just of all the different things they might need to get their heads around and what next steps to take. Honestly, thank you. It's been brilliant.
Oh, you're very welcome. I've really enjoyed
Good.
nattering with you about this. So that's it from us this week. Thank you once again for listening. If you'd like to help support the editing podcast, we've got a couple of options for you. The first is that you can tip us with a one-off donation of your choosing.
Or you can choose to join our Patreon community. All of our patrons get exclusive access to a huge batch of transcripts.
So the links to both of these are in the show notes. In the meantime, she's been Louise.
And she's been the fabulous Denise. Join us again next time.
Bye.
Bye-bye.